College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
Let me tell you, there is nothing better than getting texts from Pollock early in the morning after he watches tape all day. He's hot on a few teams, including Clemson and Auburn. And later on the podcast, Ivan Maizel will join us to discuss the California bill, opening the door for college athletes to collect money from endorsement deals. But first, our boy from Georgia joining us after a week of resting his voice and not yelling at his son's football teams. David, how you feeling and how's the voice?
First of all, things people have never said is nothing like getting a text from Pollock in the morning. A, we'll address that. B, but the voice is good, Ben. We're back in business, so I'm ready to talk some college football. I'm glad my texts aren't annoying you yet.
Yeah, I'm glad too. We'll see. I had to turn my phone off at a certain point. My wife was giving me the cross-eyed look, like, "Who's texting you now?" I'm like, "We'll talk about it later. Will you listen to the podcast?" Pollock is hot on a few things. All right, I do though. Before we get to the tape and what you watched in the film room. It's been a discussion all week long because we have a new number one in the country. Who's your number one team in the country right now?
Ohio State. I think Ohio State, to me, has looked the most dominant. And, yes, it hasn't been the greatest strength of schedule yet. But both sides of the ball, I see impact players all over the field. I see a coach that knows exactly what he's doing with the quarterback, a special talent like Justin Fields. So, I think to me, this has got to be some eye test, right? Like, this can't just be all, you know, who they played and blah, blah, blah. Everything has to come into a play. And, you know, because of that, I say Ohio State, Nebraska's a pretty decent football team. Cincinnati's a pretty decent football team. Those weren't competitive games because Ohio State's been so great up until this point. A lot of other teams like Alabama haven't truly been tested. Texas has to be up there because of the huge win against Texas. But completeness, domination, so far to me it's Ohio State.
Yeah, you mentioned LSU, they had that bye, and Georgia had the bye as well. Then where do you put Clemson and where do you put Alabama? Who's number two?
Neither. I wouldn't have either one of them at number two. I would have Alabama at number three. I would have Georgia at number two, and I have LSU at number four.
So you have Clemson at five?
I would have Clemson at five, correct.
And then where would Auburn be? I imagine Auburn would be six?
I would be okay if you put Auburn at five right now. I wouldn't even be upset with that. But I would definitely have Clemson on the outside looking in right now. And I know that Clemson fans are going to be irate, whatever. First of all, if you haven't played anybody up to this point of note, you better be dominant. And watching the North Carolina tape again and everybody watching that this weekend, you could tell they weren't dominant. And so they'll have plenty of time to get this ship righted and get things straight, and they have all the talent in the world to do so, and I believe that they will do so. Here's the other thing, too. Everybody gets their panties in a wad early in the year. Mm-hmm. We're going into October, dude. Last year, going into October, there was 14 undefeated teams. At the end of October, there was four. This year, there's 18. At the end of October, I promise you, when we get to November, there's going to be a handful of teams at the very best that are undefeated. So, right now, from body of work, what I've seen, I would have Clemson on the outside looking at the playoffs.
You studied a ton of tape. You watched that film against North Carolina. What's wrong with Clemson in this offense, especially when you look at the weapons, a bunch of Sunday guys, Trevor Lawrence, yeah, a guy that was, you know, the Heisman favorite at the start of the season. What's wrong with this team right now? Because we're waiting for them to click, and they have not flipped that switch.
No, and this kind of reminds me, Kevin, of Florida State 2014.
Yes.
Remember when Jameis Winston and company came off of a run where they won a championship and everybody's coming
back? I said that Monday with Herbie. I said this is exactly that 2014 team where there are close games and you're waiting and you're waiting and you're waiting.
They got stomped out when they played a really good team. But now here's the thing. I watched Clemson, and let me tell you what's the positives. Trevor Lawrence and Higgins and Ross, they're unguardable. I mean, the back shoulder connection was very much there. The touchdown to Higgins to pull back and take the lead was a thing of beauty. And Trevor Lawrence still shows you moments of beauty. I'll say this: I think there's a couple points on the team that have to get better. One, I think they have to get better up the middle. The center and guard combination, they weren't super stout up the middle. Pass protection wasn't great. They weren't getting a lot of movement. And what happened was, to me, I think Clemson panicked. I think they stopped running the football. They carried the ball, non-running backs carried the ball four times in the second half. Four. And four carries. And this is a team that I think thrives and works best when they have the running game going. And it takes games like Syracuse a year ago. Remember when Kelly Bryant had just transferred, Trevor Lawrence is getting his first start, and he gets banged up, and Chase Bryce comes in, and all of a sudden they're like, okay, we better give it to ETN. Dude goes for over 200. I think it's just, it's got to be a mindset of we're going to run the football no matter what. And so I think they kind of got away from the run game, and I think that that kind of hurt them because they became predictable. And I'll tell you another thing that's a glaring weakness. Travis Etienne in pass protection. He had some moments where he looked really bad. And, you know, he had a moment where he looked really good, but 21 for North Carolina ate his lunch. I mean, he a couple times just absolutely put him on like a bug meat in a windshield, bro. So it was, you know, I, again, I'm not panicked of what I see for Clemson, and I think they can ratchet it up and depend more on the run and become more physical because they never have been up front on the offensive line, a physically dominating unit because of their scheme. But I think you'll see a Clemson team that definitely is more committed to the run with the running back.
Yeah, and you mentioned Surratt was everywhere. He was fantastic. I was more stunned at how the – were you okay with the idea of going for two there? Because I was okay with Mac's decision to go for two.
Here's the thing to realize if you're going to put yourself – I think every game is different, first of all. Analytics, schmamalytics. Not every game is the same.
Yep.
But if I'm playing and I'm Mac Brown and I'm down by 1 point and I have an opportunity to tie it, and now I have to go possibly into overtime, by the way, because Trevor Lawrence still gets the ball back with a minute plus. So my odds either way are going to be tough. But am I going to be better in a situation where I have to run 4 to 8 to 12 plays offensively now to beat a very good, overly talented Clemson team, or can I beat them one time from the 3-yard line or 2-yard line? Like, to me, you go for it. You absolutely go for the win and try to end it there in one play, try to get the dub. I think Mac Brown did the right thing. I think his players wanted that, and they got it.
Tough loss for Mac and a survival for Dabo, who seems to go through this at least once a year, and now then they press the reset button. They have that bye week before they take off on Florida State. But the one thing that's going to hurt him the rest of the way is that schedule as it plays out. And we've discussed this ad nauseum at the start of the year that their toughest games were in that first month. We weren't expecting their toughest game would be North Carolina, but from here on out, when you look at it on paper, it's going to play against him if you have a bunch of other undefeated teams. So they're going to have to do that, like you said, the eye test, and they're going to have to smoke some teams.
We're not going
here to
have a bunch of other undefeated teams. We don't. We never do.
We just want
to do this assuming they run the table stuff all the time, and it's just not going to happen, bro. I mean, think about the SEC. LSU is going to play Alabama.
Yeah.
Alabama and LSU, one of the two is going to play Georgia. There you go. Two of the three are already not undefeated anymore. Penn State, Ohio State are going to play. Boom, boom. Undefeated. Can't happen anymore. So I think it's fun things to temper down, simmer down, realize it's going to come to a head and all this stuff will work itself out.
And we'll see a lot of things work itself out over the weekend. We're going to talk specifically about that Auburn-Florida game. That'll work itself out a little bit, too, as game day is going to be there on Friday and Saturday. First off, though, I want to know, as you watch that film, which unit is turning heads when you look at the tape?
I tell you what, I loved what I saw from Auburn's offense a week ago. And I think Auburn's offense has a chance to really, really turn the corner. Bo Nix looked really good. And listen, he's not going to be a finished product, Kevin, but what I saw from him was more decisiveness. What I saw from him was seeing the blitz better and throwing the ball more efficiently. And I'm talking about efficient, Kevin. He was 16 of 21 for 335, and it wasn't just one throw. It wasn't just quick game. It wasn't just bubble screens. Like, he showed you in cover two, he attacks the weakness to Williams, you know, the honey hole in cover two is that outside corner, outside of where the corner squats towards the sideline. He attacked it. He attacked the middle of the field when Mississippi State brought pressure from the middle of the field. Like, did a great job. And here's the thing I like about this Auburn offense that started to take shape. Gus Malzahn ran his quarterback. 12 design runs this game. Kevin, the highest design runs per game for them up to this point was 4.
Mm-hmm.
So they made a concerted effort, and Bo Nix looks the part. He's not just a pocket passer. You've seen him run. He can run the football and make big plays. Oh, and by the way, you've got Williams, who's enormous wide receiver, fast wide receiver, big target. You've got Schwartz, who's burning people with the jet now that you have to honor. They have the ability now, I think, in this offense. It's just going to continue to grow where it could be something very special because the wideouts fit. They're practicing. They're healthy together. The quarterback's growing. The offensive line is solid. The running backs are solid. They got a chance. They could make a run with the thing on offense.
They got five guys over 100 yards on the ground this season, and Whitlow's been fantastic. This feels – I talked about this with Herbie. I mentioned it briefly. When you have the passing attack with LSU, you have the passing attack in Alabama, this feels like an old-school SEC team, right? You win by that defensive line in that front and the quarterback to make three or four plays and then just pound, pound, pound with your running attack. And then get a little creative. We're seeing Gus open the playbook a little bit more.
I've actually seen more routes from Gus and the offense, you know, stacking wide receivers together, bunching them up and, you know, running comebacks, doing more, expanding the playbook and the route tree, which I think is an important part of the offense. It's been very predictable. It's been goes and quick throws. And now I think they're starting to do a better job of incorporating different routes, and that would make them harder to defend too.
So that's the unit that stands out so far, and we're talking to Auburn, of course. But briefly, you've also examined some film on Florida and their offense as they get ready for this showdown, and it's a different offense with Kyle Trask, and it's still the same stuff, the same elements, and everybody else is the same outside of the quarterback position. But you're seeing something that's different with Trask compared to Felipe Franks. What are you seeing?
It's a better offense, Kevin. I don't mean that. You know, I don't want to be disrespectful to anybody, but this is a team. By the way, Florida, they're not a running team. They can't run the ball against Townsend. They can't. They're not a. They're not going. Their offensive line is not good enough to line up and pound you. That's not going to be what they are. By far, what they do best is their wide receiver core is fast, and they can get out and they can make plays in the back end. So I need a quarterback that can throw the ball accurately. I need a quarterback that can push the ball down the field. I need a quarterback that can throw on time and look to throw. Kyle Trask is better suited for this offense. The strength of this team is its wide receivers. I have to feature my wide receivers. And so I think – you know, he looks similar to Felipe. He's 6'5", he's 240, but efficiency-wise, he's been a model of efficiency. I mean, think about it, like in such a game, he comes in and he goes 9 of 13, and then Tennessee comes around, and you want to see it again, right? 20 of 28, and then Townsend, 18 of 20. I mean, he really has done a great job. Now, listen, there are flaws, and there are, you know, when he feels pressure, I think he becomes very average, but if you give him a clean pocket, which is tough to do against Auburn. If you give him a clean pocket, keep him upright, he can make some plays over the middle of field. He can make some deep throws, and he can really take this offense to a level that I don't think Felipe could have through the air.
What's going to be the difference in a game like this? Because you mentioned it. You mentioned it a couple times. You can't get over one fact, and that is the protection of that offensive line. And obviously they have a lot of new parts, and they've been trying to gel the last – five games for them, and they still haven't found that consistency with the running game, even though they have a ton of talent in that backfield. What's going to be the difference here for Florida, considering who they got on the other side, and maybe the best defensive line in the country in Auburn?
Well, if you take us back a year ago and think about Dan Mullen and think about this offense, remember they traveled to Mississippi State, and they played against Sweat and Simmons inside, enormous guys that they 100% couldn't block. And actually, that was my thinking in my head was like, when was the last time they played a really good offensive line, you know, inexperienced quarterback? And you go back to that game, and I actually looked at that game. I don't have problems. I'm not saying I don't. and if you go back and watch the game, 21 of 33 passes in that ball game were quick game, were to wide receivers, were to screens, were literally three-step drops, get the ball out of your hand right now immediately. That's how you do it. I would say, you know, another thing they did, snap the ball to Tony, snap the ball to other guys, skill guys that can get the ball, get downhill in a hurry as opposed to wasting more time on other stuff, and have a few gadgets. You got to have a few trick plays in your bag. Last year, they throw a pass to Tony. Their only touchdown of the game was a double pass. Throw it to Tony out wide, Tony throws it down the field for a touchdown. So I think you got to try to mix it up, and you got to find a way to have some kind of balance. But they're going to use the quick game. They're going to use some trick plays, maybe use some no huddle. You know, one area I think if you want to really get Auburn, I would try to tempo these guys a little bit, man. Try to get the big beef, because they got a bunch of guys, Derek Brown or Marlon Davidson or Big Cat Bryant, Nick Coe, all those guys are 250-plus pound guys, most of them, you know, 280 pounds or more. Try to get them in a hot sun and try to get them moving and try to get them tired, and then maybe you can equal it out and have some success.
We'll be back in a minute as Pollock tells us about the strongest guy he's seen on tape so far this season. But first, a word from Allstate. Because mayhem on Saturdays in the fall is inevitable. Mayhem happens on the field, off the field, and in the polls. Mayhem lives on the wind. in the rain, on the foot of an errant kick, and during a trap game. You'll find mayhem in the parking lot, during tailgates, charcoal that's not totally out, an errant football through a window, a flat tire, a lost side view mirror, etc. You get the point. Allstate protects you from mayhem in the parking lot and outside it, at home and away. You can't stop mayhem from happening, but you can get better protected from it with Allstate. The potential for mayhem during the playoff race is rampant. Underdogs, trap games, unexpected weather, etc., etc., etc. Get better protected from mayhem with Allstate. Contact your local Allstate agent today. Now back to the show. All right, so my day job is SportsCenter during the week. This is kind of my hobby. I love the podcast. I love doing stuff with college football, especially on Saturdays on ABC. But the people over at SportsCenter, apparently they're fans of the podcast if they're stealing ideas from us with this David's Dude. And we were ahead of the curve here talking about the guys that are under the radar we should be talking about. And you've given us, you know, for the last 5 weeks, somebody that stands out, somebody that's a stud that we're not talking about. Who's that guy this week that we should be talking about this weekend?
KJ Britt. Half the country is not going to know who KJ Britt is. You probably don't as well. He's number 33. He's a linebacker for Auburn. Kevin, he is a hammer, bro. I love turning on the tape and watching this dude play football. When you see offensive linemen come up to linebackers nowadays, back in my day, when the game was a lot bigger and more physical, you saw linebackers that would come downhill and stripe offensive tackles, and their head would bow back real quick. You see very little of that right now in college football. When 33 comes downhill for Auburn, he comes downhill with some bad intentions, and he pops people, and just you can see offensive linemen get absolutely stoned. He chases the ball with an intent to kill people, with an intent to get there like he's chasing food, man, and he hadn't eaten in 3 days. And he's just starving. I love the way KJ Britt plays. I know we're going to talk about, you know, Coe and Brown and Davidson and Big Cat and all those guys. But I tell you what, 33 stood out to me when I watched the tape for Auburn.
Well, there's a bunch of guys, too. You were on a roll here. You talked about Marlon Davidson. You were raving about Christian Tutt. Like, who else? You know, when you look at the way Auburn is put together at the three levels on the defensive side, what's working for them?
Well, first of all, Derrick Brown, he's the strongest kid I think I've ever seen inside a defensive tackle. Like, the first play in the A&M game, A&M runs a little pin and pull, and they literally try to pull their center around, and they try to smack Derrick Brown. And, Kevin, when I say he literally looked like he was locking out my 100-pound son, that's what it looked like. He hit that guy, locks him out, and literally throws him, hit the eject button, out of the seat, ejects him about a yard and a half backwards, just absolutely debos him and makes a tackle for a loss in the backfield. And just like his power in his hands are unbelievable, Nifty for 318 pounds. But it all starts in the front seven for me for Auburn. It's Derrick Brown, it's Davidson, those guys. But all of them are big and physical, Kevin, and they never play on their side of the line of scrimmage. Everything they do, they dictate to you. If you want to run off tackle, well, you're going to have to run off tackle and bounce that thing out wide. If you want to run inside, we're going to make you bounce that thing outside. They do such a phenomenal job of penetration and playing physical. And, yeah, I mean, I mentioned Tuitt to you. You watch Tuitt close on some of these bubble screens. I'm just like, dude, that kid's a blur. I mean, he's got some serious speed. So, well coached, but to me, their front seven just makes them different than most teams in the country because they don't have one guy. They don't have two guys. They got three or four guys that are really interchangeable parts that can really make offenses difficult because they get penetration and they ruin what you want to try to accomplish.
Okay, so they got a bye after Florida. Let's just hypothetically play scenarios out here, and they win in Gainesville after that bye at Arkansas, then October 26th against LSU. The way this defense is, and let's not forget that in November is Georgia at home, Alabama at home. How this is set up here. What do you need to see, not so much from the Auburn defense, but what do you need to see in the growth of Bo Nix offensively in the next few weeks to get ready for that game on the road in Baton Rouge?
Because like you think about on the road in Baton Rouge, first of all, obviously one of the toughest atmospheres you're going to play in college football. So that's going to be difficult. But you also think about as good as the offensive or defensive line is and defensive front seven for Auburn, Joe Burrow's still going to make plays. By the way, Joe Burrow right now is the best quarterback I've seen run the RPO game. I mean, just he'll hold it to the last second and wait for a second window. His patience in the RPO game is what makes him special. But so I got to go tick for tack. So I'm going to keep watching Bo Nix, man. Last week, obviously, lit it up, looked great. Auburn's field position was phenomenal all game long, especially early. It makes it, you know, very easy. But it's just his evolution. If he can continue to make passes in the passing game, if he keeps being a willing runner. Like I said, 12 design runs for him. That's not going to be something you live by. Against Arkansas, you don't need it. Against Florida, you need it some. Against some of these other teams, you're not going to need it. But when you play Georgia and when you play Alabama and you play LSU, you dang sure are going to need that plus one in the run game and the illusion of him going one way, the running back going the other way. So it's Bo Nix, man, the offense. Can they continue to be efficient, score points? Can he continue to run, throw, and not make mistakes?
All right, let's go, shift gears here because you brought it up briefly about the Ohio State experience and what you saw and calling them the number one team in the country. When you see this whole thing play out, and we watched a little bit about, you know, Wisconsin's defense, we've seen how great they are. We've seen a little bit of Penn State, and they've kind of given us like a teaser on the potential down the road. Where do things stand in your mind and how the Big Ten is playing out at this moment?
Ohio State and Penn State, I think those are the teams that...
Not Wisconsin?
No, I don't put Wisconsin there yet. And I tell you what, a little bit, when I watch, here's the thing, man, it's hard to judge early in the season, right, with competition, but I know their defense is going to be stout. I know the defense is going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they have the athletic ability to stay with a team like Ohio State. I think that's going to be what we've seen in the past when they've played really athletic, fast teams, and you start spreading them out on the perimeter and make them play man coverage and stick screens out and Justin Fields is running all over the place. I mean, Ballin's a really good athlete, but all those guys in the front seven going to continue to rotate in and out and be deep enough and fast enough? I don't think so. Penn State can. What I've seen from Penn State's front seven and those guys up front, I'm a big fan, man. I think there is – I've said this before to you already ad nauseum, and I think people are probably sick of hearing it, but this is the most athletic I have seen Penn State in the front seven in the James Franklin era. And if you're watching Vitor Gross Matos? I can't even say his name. How do you say it? I go Yitor. Yitor is easier to say. If you watch 99, that's the kind of guy that can play the zone. That's the kind of guy that can play the zone read and run things down from the backside and go with Fields, can run with Fields. You know, and if they got multiple guys, I think up front too, and in the front seven that are just athletic that can run with them. So I think right now, to me, from what I've seen, I think it's Penn State and Ohio State that athletically are the two closest to each other.
So it's Vitor Gross-Matos.
Okay, yeah, like I said, 99.
Yeah, 99, and Vitor. Yeah. I think the entire country will keep an eye on this young man as we're going to see him on the big stage more and more as the season progresses, especially with their showdown at Iowa, then Michigan State, and then in November they got Ohio State on the road. Hey, listen, we didn't get any picks yet. We're going to save all that. That breakdown with Florida and Auburn was great, but I cannot wait to hear your picks. That's coming up on Friday when you're on the road and you're going to be in Gainesville getting ready for game day. Appreciate it, Pollock. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me, bud.
We'll be back in a minute with Ivan Maizel about the Fair Pay to Play Act. But first, a word from Goodyear. Sometimes for inspiration, you just have to look up. For more than 60 years, the Goodyear blimp has fueled greatness on the gridiron by providing aerial coverage of some of the most legendary moments in college football history. When the Goodyear blimp rises above a stadium, it inspires players to reach higher and rise to the challenge of the game's biggest moments. Now it's your turn to go further with Goodyear. Discover tires made to rise above the rest. Learn more at Goodyear.com. Goodyear, more driven. Now back to the show. As he does every Wednesday, great to have Ivan Maizel join us here on the College Football Podcast. And Ivan, we're going to talk football in a moment, but let's talk in general, a big deal to a lot of people on the outside. On September 30th, the California governor, Gavin Newsom, signed the Fair Pay to Play Act. And that opens the door potentially for college athletes in that state to collect money from endorsement deals without the fear of losing their scholarships or eligibility from the NCAA, but it won't go into effect until January of 2023. And now we've seen since that deal, or since it was signed, on LeBron's show, other states are perking up and now discussing the possibility of signing something similar. What's your first reaction? Because it felt like there are just two sides of this story. It's, hey, fantastic, finally, and then, oh no, this is the end of college athletics.
Yes. Well, to me, I feel as if the legislators in California have played the NCAA like a violin. I mean, if this were a contest, it would be a rout. Because what Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, has said is, we wanted to put this out there, have other states see it was okay to do it, and then they will follow suit, and then the NCAA will have to act because there will have to be one universal rule. And that's exactly what the box or the corner that the NCAA is now being painted in. I am far from an advocate of paying players. I'm late to this party, but name, image, and likeness is a logical next step. And the fact that the NCAA has not seen that is just so depressing.
When you say not seeing it, yeah, because they've had time. This has been boiling over. And now you have a guy like Gavin Newsom, who I think is, you know, unfortunately we're getting into politics here, because the NCAA is a reactive foundation here. They're a reactive association. They are not active. They are not ahead of the curve. It always feels like Mark Emmert is reacting to something. I want to know where the commissioners have been on this, because this has been building up. It has been bubbling over, and now you kind of lose control of it, and you see a guy like Gavin Newsom, who probably has bigger aspirations outside of being the governor of California. Now you see other states saying, oh, we have to jump in on this. So now it gets out of their hands, the NCAA, and now we're going to see a reaction instead of something like, hey, we're going to be ahead of this, let's be innovative. And that's the biggest problem, right? Because this thing, the gap from everybody else getting paid, right, when we're talking about ADs, commissioners, coaches, and everybody else affiliated with college athletics, and to the players, it has just been widening over the years, and nothing's been done. And you could bring up stipends, but they fought stipends.
They did, and eventually they came around to it because they had to. They were pretty much publicly shamed into the food and stipends. You know, they were late to doing that. And part of it is the NCAA is, it's not this monolithic organization that we all paint it in Indianapolis. It is an association of hundreds of schools. And so they're always going to move slowly. But it's been obvious for some time, at least to me, that public sentiment was going this way. And rather than get in front or even lead from behind, they're being dragged. That doesn't mean that they can't come up with a good, smart, effective rule, effective, you know, NCAA legislation to handle it. But you know, certainly the optics of it and the feeling that they are looking out for the best interest of the sport is not there. You know, it feels like they're protecting their fiefdoms, which is usually how the NCAA ends up playing things.
Okay, how do you view this concept, though, that the elite teams will now only benefit, like the gap is going to be even wider and wider? How do you view that? Because I have an opinion, but I want to hear what your thoughts are on this concept that we've heard the last few days since the bill was signed. Oh no, this is going to be the end of everything. All the teams that you think are great are going to be better than everybody else even more.
I am stunned, Kevin, to learn that the playing field is not level. this came as a great shock to me, because I've only been covering this stuff for 40 years. And to learn suddenly this week that New Mexico State was not as on the same level as Alabama, that, you know, Alabama was actually not going to go to Las Cruces and play a game because New Mexico State was there this year. Stunning. So, you know, there's never been a level playing field. And the rules that the NCAA put in across the board their level best, to make a level playing field. But, the marketplace is the marketplace. And listen, the marketplace is the reason that these salaries have become astronomical, mm-hmm. and nobody bats an eye. And I think, this is not it's a big step, but it's a long way from name, image, likeness royalties to paying players. There's still a big gap there. And, once they figure out how to police this, and that's the biggest problem, and I don't have a solution. Once they figure out how to, rein in the $25,000 car dealer appearance, mm-hmm. Then I think everything can go on pretty much the way it has.
Can you see a scenario? Let's just talk about, the major programs here. And those are like the Notre Dames. We can mention three or four teams in the SEC, like Alabama, like Georgia, like LSU, like Florida. Can you see a scenario, or let's go to Penn State, let's go to Ohio State, again, Michigan, Clemson, where all this five-star talent, which it feels like has been going to only about 10 teams, 10 schools, right? And they're getting multiple five-star guys, where there's a five-star guy who says, you know what, that piece of the pie is going to be split by four other five-star guys at this one school. I'm going to another school where I can be the man. And that, I don't know, that could be, a smaller power five school. That could be potentially a group of five school. And says a kid, who says, I'm not going to go to Florida. I'm not going to go to Miami. I'm not going to go to Florida State because they're getting all these five-star guys. I'm going to go to UCF. I'll be the only five-star guy. I'm going to go to Florida Atlantic. I'll be the only five-star guy in that area, and then I can make the most money. Can you see that scenario? Because if you play that scenario out, you could see some guys who are four- and five-star guys saying, I'm not going with the group. I want to go somewhere else because then I want to make sure I can maximize my potential in making money.
Oh, that is really interesting. The pot, I would think, would be bigger, obviously, at the bigger name schools.
Yeah.
But that said, I don't know how you can allow name, image, likeness funds or royalties to go into a pot to be split by everyone. I mean, maybe you can,
mm-hmm.
but to me, the whole point of, would allow an athlete to profit off of his or her name, image, or likeness, I would think would mean that particular athlete would get that particular money.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't think in that case that, whatever the big pot is that that you're referring to would matter per se. It would be how big of a shadow could this athlete cast at whatever community they're in, and how many jerseys would be sold, how many photographs could be sold, whatever it is, however this thing plays out. So in that sense, I would think the money from certainly outside sources would be available wherever they go.
Yeah. It's a fascinating thing too, because the opportunity for many of these athletes to make money through their social media feeds, selling t-shirts online, advertising to give lessons in a sport to younger kids. I find that great because I think of many of these guys going back home and having camps. Many of these athletes, and that's not just in football or basketball, but many of these athletes going back where they could teach a summer camp, with their name and make some money, right, on the side. And I don't think it's the end of the world. I definitely don't think it's going to oh my goodness. Now it's not going to be fair for everybody. Cause like you said, it hasn't been fair ever. It has never been fair.
No.
And that's just the state of things. Life isn't fair. And you're learning firsthand in college. It's never going to be fair.
Well, and this, and what you bring up, this is not going to be a panacea. This is not going to cure all ills. It's going to have its own problems, and kids, they're going to, some of them will succeed at this. Some of them will, be taken. Some of them will lose their shirts. It's going to be just until there is some sort of system that's created, and maybe the schools could, it would be funneled through the schools so that the schools would handle the money. The schools know how to handle that kind of money. You know, all that's got to be figured out, and it's not going to be easy to figure it out. But again, it was easier in the short term for the NCAA to just close its eyes and pretend this wasn't happening. And by doing that, they've put themselves in a very difficult position now.
Yeah, and again, in the position of being reactive instead of active and ahead of the curve, and or proactive. And it's unfortunate.
Yes.
And now one governor, and we'll see how this plays out with other states. And again, it till January of 2023. So we have that 3-year window to kind of figure things out, because you know it's not just going to be one state. If it is one state, oh my goodness, then I think the entire SEC and the Big Ten, the ACC, will all lose their mind, because they don't want to lose all their players to the state of California.
This is how the Pac-12 is coming back.
Well, we're not going to have Pac-12 talk here with you on this segment. We did a lot of that last week with Cal. I want to talk a little bit about the Big Ten, and not so much about what we saw from Ohio State against Nebraska. They'll get that love, and they'll get even more love in October. I don't want to even focus on Michigan's shortcomings. To me, it's a couple of other teams. And, you know, Minnesota's off to a great start. They have the chance potentially to start 8-0. But there are two teams here. And Wisconsin's off to a phenomenal start. They deserve to be in that conversation when we talk about teams that are undefeated. And unfortunately, they are usually on the outside of that top six of elite teams. But they should be now more in that conversation. We'll get a little bit more into that for them as the October schedule plays out. But there are two teams here, and that is Penn State. And Penn State has Purdue this weekend, and then the showdown on the road at Iowa. And then let's tie in the Hawkeyes and Iowa.
Yep.
Two teams that are undefeated that I think that could potentially cause major problems in the conference. How do you view these two teams?
Well, I think it's interesting just that, because especially Penn State, nobody's talking about them, and they have looked, the offense, with the exception of the Pitt game, and that's, it's no crime to struggle against the Pitt defense. The offense has been incredible. Sean Clifford, I certainly didn't see this coming, you know, to put up 79 and 59 points with a kid who's played very little. And, that does make me sound like a dinosaur, because now kids are stepping in everywhere and playing like they've been there all along. And Sean Clifford's just one more.
Mm-hmm.
He's got 9 touchdowns, 1 interception. The offense is doing certainly much better than I expected. And, with Purdue struggling, I mean, it looks very easy for Penn State to go into Iowa with an unbeaten record. Iowa's a little tougher deal. They got to go to the Big House this week. We've talked about Michigan's struggles a lot, but they are going to be home. And this is a way to, for Michigan to try to reestablish itself within the league and maybe even nationally by knocking off Iowa. And it looks like a typical good Kirk Ferentz team,
mm-hmm.
Kevin, to me. Not flashy. Not a lot of mistakes, very sound, and they end up winning the game. For all the talk of how important October is going to be for the SEC, I think it's really going to be a lot of fun to watch the Big Ten race unfold during the month as well.
Two things that really stand out when you watch Penn State is, of course, the human joystick and KJ Hamler, and Clifford's fully aware. Get him the ball, and good things will happen. I love their running back by committee, because I think they have a ton of talent in that backfield as they try to figure out who's going to be the hot hand. But their defense, Ivan, is so athletic. When you watch them play, that's the one thing that stands out. They are everywhere on the field, and that's refreshing to see. As a kid that grew up in a Penn State family and who has 9 cousins that went to Penn State, I'm fully aware of linebacker U, but this feels like a different type of linebacker U. They are all over the football. Now, I understand, it's Idaho, Buffalo, Pitt, and Maryland. And we're going to see a different team here against Iowa on October 12th, then Michigan State. But if they come out of that undefeated, then they got the bye, and then Minnesota. And at the end of November 23rd, on the road at Ohio State, if they are undefeated, you can make a strong case that this team will be a potentially top five team coming into that contest against Ohio State.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it sets up, they've got tough road games, as you pointed out. I mean, they get a week off between having to go to East Lansing and having to go to Minnesota, and it's right there for them. I mean, you know, to be 14 now with the schedule they have, they'll easily be, if they keep going, they'll be right where they want to be. And let's not forget Rutgers that last weekend.
Yeah. We can't forget about the Scarlet Knights. Who knows what direction they decide to go into when it comes to their coaching situation, which I'm fascinated by that because fully aware of, my roots being in the Philadelphia area. They're a team with when it comes to Temple that, looks in that hotbed of recruiting in South Jersey as well as Central Jersey. But you see all these other schools that always, especially a team like Penn State, that poaches the fantastic talent in Jersey. How about Iowa? And you mentioned Ferentz. This is a classic team. It feels like Nate Stanley's been there for 10 years, and he's doing the same things over and over again. It's time of possession. Control the football, be very smart with the football, and then as the season progresses, your defense gets tougher and tougher.
Yeah, I remember when he replaced Brad Banks. That's what. To me, what's fascinating about Iowa is, throughout Ferentz's career, it's been sort of cyclical. It's almost like he gets a young class, and we just have to wait for them to get their feet under them, and then by the time they're upperclassmen, Iowa's back at the top of the league again. But this is a pretty young defense, and to play the way they have, and when you have a veteran quarterback and a little older offense, that does bode well for the defense. But they've stopped people that are pretty good on offense. I mean, they've stopped. To do what they did against Iowa State on the road. It's going to be very interesting. They're stepping up in competition this week. Michigan's problems on offense are well established, but they're not going to get well playing against this Iowa defense.
Well, if they come out of that game at the Big House, and then you got Penn State at home, Purdue at home, which is homecoming, Northwestern, then the bye, but circle November 9th on the road, they go to Madison. And I want to learn a lot more about Wisconsin. And when Wisconsin looks in the mirror and they see an Iowa team that understands what they're doing and they're going to do potentially the same thing, and how are they going to have time of possession on both sides of the ball? That's going to be a great matchup in November. Ivan, always a pleasure to have you on with us here on Wednesdays. We appreciate it. I'm glad we gave some love to those two teams in the Big Ten.
Great. Thanks, Kevin.
That'll wrap things up here. Appreciate Pollock and Ivan for joining us. Also want to thank our sponsors, Allstate and Goodyear. Wondering what Vegas thinks about this week's game? Check out the Stanford Steve and the Bear podcast as they break down games and make their picks. Remember to subscribe to Stanford Steve and the Bear, as well as the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock, wherever you get your podcasts. Big thanks to our producers, Taylor Schwenk and Gabe Bassane. Coming up on Friday, Pollock makes his picks. He also gives us his Heisman guy if the season ended today. Enjoy the week. We'll see you on Friday.